And I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Our weekly mission to keep you informed on local and regional state news and issues affecting our community with a panel of the area's top journalists. And this week we'll welcome our newcomer first. Perhaps no TV reporter has done more reporting back and forth from Haiti than Nicole Insalata, who is a reporter with WSVN TV Channel 7. We'll talk about the third anniversary of the earthquake, and we welcome you, Nicole. Good to have you.
Thank you very much.
Brian Bandel is an author and a senior reporter at the South Florida Business Journal. He covers banking, healthcare, insurance, real estate, foreclosures, and the general economy. We'll be talking about a lot of those things in the next hour with him. Mr. Bandel, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Phil. I'm glad to be here. And if you want to know more about my novel, Mute, it's at silverleafbooks.com.
All right. We'll talk about that and some other stuff he's working on. But Elliot Rodriguez, he's just, boy, you talk about your timing.
Perfect timing, no?
Perfect timing. He's just pulled in. He is the longtime South Florida journalist, former newspaper man for a while at the Miami Herald, although I doubt people even remember that at this point, right? It's been a while. But he's, of course, better known for his work on television, now as a news anchor on WFOR-TV, and he makes a return appearance just in time. Welcome back, Elliot.
Great to be here, Phil. Thank you very much.
So let's tee it up with the discussion on healthcare in Florida. The Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration on Wednesday released a report that slashed the estimated costs for key parts of the federal healthcare law. The report finds Florida's cost could be as low as $3 billion over 10 years. That's a big drop from the nearly $26 billion figure the agency reported last month. These estimates come as Governor Scott faces charges of using the higher number in his criticism of the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare. Now, even after this new report comes out, the governor kept up the attack on the ACA on WFLA radio yesterday.
The federal government gets to make all the decisions. And then the Florida taxpayers were on the hook for their decisions. That's not right. If they want to be responsible for everything, then let them go raise the taxes to pay for it. But don't make us hurt our education system to pay for a program that they get to make all the rules on.
So the governor's been under fire since Health News Florida reported this week on emails showing that the state budget analysts thought that the estimates last month were flawed, off by $23 billion. Brian Bandel, where is the discrepancy here?
Well, the governor's initial estimate, the $26 billion estimate, was assuming the government, the federal government, would not pick up 90% of the costs. Now, the law says the federal government will cover 100% of Medicaid expansion for the first few years. After that, the federal government will cover 90%. The governor assumed that the federal government would not keep its promise. And that's where he got $26 billion. But if you actually go by what the law says and assume the government will follow it, then it will be much lower than that. And he also didn't really consider the fact that the state government could save money in other ways when this happens, such as if more people have Medicaid, the state doesn't have to pay for all this uncompensated care at local hospitals.
And he talked with the HHS secretary this week, Health and Human Services Secretary Sebelius, about whether the federal government will give the state a waiver so those insured by Medicaid could be shifted to managed care programs. Now, Florida got that waiver. What would it mean for somebody here in Florida that is on Medicaid since they're trying to expand it here?
Well, it means that instead of going to whichever doctor you want, whichever hospital you want, you would be a bit more limited in your choices in managed care. At times, they would be able to deny certain doctor visits or services. But for the state, they're trying to make it mean you get savings. I know that when they initially started managed care in Broward, there were some people who said, okay, well, you now have to go see a doctor 15 miles away. You can't see this doctor. He's not on our plan. So there could initially be some confusion. And that's supposed to start in 2014, but they just haven't gotten approval yet.
So how much federal money would the state be turning away if they got that waiver?
Well, the federal spending is going to be over $42 billion, according to the state's latest estimate. That would be over 10 years. And think about that. For every dollar the state spends, the federal government puts in $9 here. And those dollars could potentially create jobs. If you think of a doctor's office that right now can't see patients who don't have coverage, if that patient has Medicaid, they can see that doctor office. That's federal dollars flowing into the state, creating some economic activity.
Elliot, you know, politically speaking, Governor Scott's pretty unpopular right now, and whether he knew or not that these numbers were wrong, it certainly doesn't look good that the governor of the state is overestimating by $26 or $23 billion. How do you think this will play politically for him?
I don't think it'll play very well. We have a governor who campaigned openly against Obamacare and has been a longtime opponent of it. And now, you know, you say numbers don't lie, but which numbers do you believe? And in fact, I read that there's one group that says the figure is even lower. Instead of $5 billion, it could be as low as $2.7 billion over a 10-year period. So there's some debate even about the new numbers.
And I think there's always that debate here in Florida and elsewhere about the fact that once you are covered by health care and you can do these preemptive care and get things treated before they become problems, you can save money along the line that way as well. But, you know, I guess, Brian, the issue now is whether they implement this health care exchange if the federal government comes in and does it for the state. What do you think is going to happen there? Will the state finally and the federal government finally come to an agreement on that?
Well, the state missed the deadline to tell the federal government they want to do a health care exchange for people with commercial insurance plans. The federal government will start the process of setting up an exchange and writing the rules. Now, it's always possible that Florida legislature could change its mind and say, okay, we want to start a state exchange now. Work with us. Maybe you'll do a federal exchange for 1 year and we'll jump in the next year. I know that a lot of the managed care plans would like that. The hospital associations in Florida would like that. It's just a question of whether there's the will in the legislature and whether the governor wants to do it, because it's going to happen whether they like it or not. It's just a question of who writes the rules for how the exchange works.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman, our guest this hour. Nicole Insulata from WSVN TV Channel 7. We'll hear from her in just a little bit. She's going to talk about her coverage of Haiti and a lot of other things that she covers on her beat as a reporter for Channel 7. Elliot Rodriguez from WFOR TV Channel 4 also with us. Two TV people today. I think that's a record. And Brian Bandel from the South Florida Business Journal, helping us break down some economy and healthcare issues. Later in our show, we'll talk about the news about Richard Blanco, the Miami-raised Cuban-American poet that will give the inaugural poem at President Obama's swearing in, the first Latino, the first gay poet to be so honored. What does it say for and about our community? And also on the third anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti, we asked you how it has affected us in South Florida, and we'll also talk with Nicole about the progress that has been made in that country. You can also dial us up at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. We're emailable at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. And we'd also remind you that we do a lot of work on Twitter, so you can tweet us at WLRN and follow us there also. Go to WLRN.org or our Facebook page. We have a live blog going on right now that's trying to expand on some of the discussions we're having right here. So the economy, Brian, a couple more things for you just to kick off the show. We're hearing that jobs are growing, but wages are dipping in South Florida. Where are the jobs and why are people being paid less here?
Well, I actually spoke to a recruiter from Markham yesterday about wages, and he said, you know, people are looking for jobs, but companies aren't throwing crazy sums of money at people like they're free agent athletes or anything. A lot of people are moving because they think this might be a better company or the benefits might be pretty good. Not necessarily they're making more. There's such high unemployment that it's generally not hard in most fields to find someone who could fill the job, except for a few key fields such as certain IT and software developers, certain really in-demand jobs. A lot of these positions can be filled. If it's not you, it's the next person who applied. So that makes it harder to demand a higher salary.
Healthcare seems to be an industry, though, that is looking good, and based on that discussion we just had with having to expand Medicaid and all that other things, the things that are going to be happening.
Healthcare jobs are definitely available. I don't know that the salaries are going up a whole lot. When I look at a lot of the local hospitals, they're not jacking up wages a whole lot. They're trying to be very conservative. Some of it is because they're afraid of what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act. They're not quite sure, so they don't want to commit to higher salaries at the moment.
Elliot, you know, there's the great question after this great recession was, would the good jobs ever return to the region? There's a lot of jobs that you know, maybe 7-Eleven that are available or fast food restaurants, that counts as being unemployed. But are they really good jobs? Have they come back the way they were 6 years ago?
The answer to that question is probably no, and it's disappointing to a lot of people. Another disappointment is a lot of people looked at their paycheck this week, and as a result of the fiscal cliff negotiations, that 2% in the Social Security tax has now has been reinstated, and that was a nice ride for a while, but a lot of people saw that. And also, of course, the cost of health care is going up, so people are hurting. And while we've seen an economic recovery in some parts of the country, I think here in South Florida, we've been sort of lagging behind. At least that's the impression that I get from my point of view.
Right, and one final thing for Brian, and we're going to turn to Nicole and talk about some international stuff, a lot of important stuff that happened here in South Florida this week that has a flavor to it that is only South Florida, including the poet story in Venezuela and Haiti. But Brian, last week and on the show, we had a caller that had asked whether Governor Scott had met his target for 700,000 new jobs over 7 years on top of what was already expected. Is he on track to fulfill that goal?
Governor Scott is behind the pace on the 777 promise he made. In order to do that, Florida would need to create over 20,000 jobs a month over that time. And out of the past 23 months, it's only done that four times. So we're really behind the pace. I think part of the problem is, even though we hear very nice job announcements by certain companies and the governor will go to press conferences about new companies, we also see companies that are even profitable cutting jobs. Just this week, American Express cutting over 5,000 workers around the country, Morgan Stanley cutting back on workers, Citibank too. You have even big profitable companies that are cutting jobs because they can save money, not necessarily they want to survive. So that's the problem. You have creation and cuts, and it leads to slow growth.
I want to remind you before we hit the break here and change the topic to come back that we are teaming up with the Miami Herald at WLRN to present a town hall on the state legislative session. It's a collaboration that's sponsored by Global Integrity. Monday, February 25th, that is at 6:30 p.m., we'll have some leaders from the Florida legislature to take your questions. We'll hear from you on what should be on the agenda in Tallahassee when the session starts. So reserve your seat now for this live free event. Go to WLRN.org. To find out more, in addition to the live event, we'll have a series of online discussions that we'll be hosting on policy areas, including how to make Tallahassee more accountable. When we come back, we'll discuss a big week in South Florida's history internationally, the situation in Venezuela, Haiti's third-year anniversary, and the poet from Miami delivering the inaugural poem. We'll be back with that in just a moment. And welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman, our guest this hour. Nicole Insulata from WSVN TV Channel 7, Brian Bandel from the South Florida Business Journal, and Elliot Rodriguez from WFOR TV Channel 4. And we do have our live blog where you can join the online discussion. You can find it on our Facebook page, WLRN.org. You can also drop us an email at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. And we're going to take your thoughts on why Haiti matters to us here in South Florida 3 years after the earthquake in just a few moments. And first, for this segment at least, President Obama has chosen the first Latino to deliver the inaugural poem. Richard Blanco grew up in Miami. He's the son of Cuban exiles. He earned an engineering degree and a master's of fine art in poetry from Florida International University. And he was a guest this week on NPR's Morning Edition and says he's still amazed that he was chosen.
Just thinking about my parents and my grandparents and all the struggles that they've been through and how here I am, first-generation Cuban-American, and this great honor that has just come to me, and just feeling that sense of incredible gratitude and love.
Blanco is 44 years old. He's also the first gay poet to deliver the inaugural poem, and often writes about living among different cultures, drawing on from his experiences growing up in South Florida. His poem, America, is about a seven-year-old urging his family, a seven-year-old Latino, urging his family to have more American Thanksgiving.
The cherry tree, the tea party, the amber waves of grain, the masses yearning to be free, liberty and justice for all, until finally they agreed this Thanksgiving we would have turkey, as well as pork.
And that resonates with a lot of South Floridians. Blanco has submitted three poems to President Obama's team. One will be chosen when he's sworn into office on January 21st. Kind of a nice story. He doesn't live here. He's up in Maine with his partner, but just a piece of South Florida at that inauguration, Nicole.
Well, for sure. And not only that, I think it also kind of, especially with the segment that you just played, it sort of adds to that feeling that not only is it a show of diversity, but also that it's also in assimilation with some of the themes he chose for that. Someone once said that America is not really a place, it's an idea. And I think the segment you just played and what he was just talking about kind of buys into that, that we may be from somewhere else, but let's go ahead and adopt these traditions as well.
And not only, if you look at his poetry, a lot of the poetry he has authored is about living in South Florida. It's sort of interesting about growing up as that was part of it right there. You just heard the Thanksgiving poem, but he does draw on a lot of those experiences, which a lot of people can relate to here in this part of the world.
Right, and it's a nice way also, I think, to contrast what he is talking about with some of, you know, what past presidents have chosen. Robert Frost, with John F. Kennedy, with a very traditional all-American sort of poem, or his work sort of represents that ideal. Maya Angelou with Bill Clinton. And now moving a little bit forward, now we're hearing some South Florida and some Latin culture as well.
Yeah, Elliot speaks a lot for the region.
Yeah, well, you know, when you say it resonates, it completely resonates with me because, I'm also Cuban-American, and in our family, any celebration required roast pork. And at this point in my life, I don't even eat pork, but growing up, that's just the way it was. And when I read his poem about a younger member of a Cuban-American family saying, hey, for Thanksgiving, let's have turkey, just like my American friends do and just like I see on TV, instead of roasting a pig this year. And the older members of the family saying, well, we don't want to do that. And I remember in my family, the complaint always was, that stuff is so dry, turkey. And my mother would stab the turkey to try to get as much of the Cuban seasonings in it. So it really does hit a nerve with us, and we can really feel for what he is writing about. And I think it's a wonderful selection and a message about what this country is all about, and especially after this election where the Hispanic voters had such a big role in it. And this is saying, here we have a Cuban-American, a Hispanic poet, someone who grew up in this country, but brings another culture to the forefront. And I think it's just a wonderful symbol and a message about what this country is all about.
It's also great for Florida International University.
Absolutely.
This is a program they had. It's not exactly one of the STEM programs. The poetry is not one of those things that people look at and go, hey, and that's a thing you can make a living out of it. And I'm not sure he still probably has struggles to make a living out of it, but it sort of raises the profile of creative people.
How cool is it to say, what do you do for a living? Well, I'm a poet. How often do you hear that?
It's nice. So the other big story this week, well, that's resonating, if you will, to use the word of the day, comes from Venezuela and has a direct impact on a lot of us here in South Florida. Ailing Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez not able to attend his scheduled swearing in this week, leaving many Venezuelans in South Florida worried about what might happen in their homeland. Some of them are residents. Some of them are undocumented and here because of the reign of Hugo Chavez. So the announcement was made this week. He may never return alive after the cancer surgery that has kept him in a Cuban hospital indefinitely. Tensions between the government and the opposition have been building in a constitutional dispute. The Venezuelan Supreme Court ruled that he did not have to attend his swearing in. He can come back and do it later. But those Venezuelan expats in South Florida don't agree with that. Here's Juan Carlos Suarez of Fort Lauderdale.
The Venezuelan community at large here in South Florida, which is a large community, is hoping that the process, the constitutional process, is respected by the authorities in place right now. Unfortunately, it seems like that's not going to be the case.
Chavez, of course, underwent his fourth cancer-related surgery in Cuba last month. Estimated that well over 100,000 Venezuelans now live in South Florida legally. And by the way, I did spend some time in Doral this week, and Monday on WLRN we'll have more on the Venezuelan community and how they're reacting to that crisis in their homeland. But certainly, Nicole, at Channel 7, you guys are covering this sort of the way we are a little bit, too.
Absolutely. And not to veer away a little bit toward Haiti, but it also does affect Haiti to a certain degree because the Petrocaribe Fund that they are using to fund so many of their reconstruction projects, and I know we'll get into that, is an association that comes from Venezuela that was put together by the Venezuelans. So the question is, you know, will that continue if someone else, if the new party gets in, the opposition gets in, will that change?
And this here in South Florida, I don't think people realize, Elliot, how many Venezuelan Americans there are here and how big a part of the community they are.
There are thousands, and I think it was wonderful when they went out last year and some of them boarded a bus to go to New Orleans where they could vote. And it really showed how they believe in the democratic process. Of course, most of the Venezuelans here in South Florida do not think highly of Hugo Chavez. But I've been to Venezuela and I've covered press conferences where Hugo Chavez has pulled out the Constitution and said that everything he does is going to be by the Constitution. And in this case, the Constitution says that if he's not able to serve, an election would be held within 30 days. However, that Constitution also says this, and I'm quoting, if for any unforeseen reason the President of the Republic cannot be sworn in front of the National Assembly, he or she will be so before the Supreme Court. So they went before the Supreme Court, which, by the way, consists of Chavez appointees, and the Supreme Court basically said that Hugo Chavez can have a leave of absence indefinite until he comes back. So, you know,
but that's not written in the Constitution.
That's not written in the Constitution. And we have an inauguration coming up here in the United States in a couple of weeks. Imagine what it would be like if Barack Obama could not show up for his inauguration and we were sort of left in a state of limbo.
But then maybe the Democrats would say, well, he's already won. You know, he's sick, say he gets sick or whatever. Right. I mean, say the same thing happens, you think there'd be the same kind of uproar?
Well, this is not, although we're getting there, the country as divided as yeah. Venezuela. I mean, Hugo Chavez is such a polarizing figure, and that country is really split down the middle with people who love this man and just view him as a god, and people who hate him, and many of them are here. So it really shows the division. But Nicole was talking about Haiti and what it means for there. The same situation in Cuba, where Hugo Chavez is now recovering, and Cuba gets millions, if not billions, of dollars in oil revenue from Venezuela, and that is left right now up in the air.
All right, quickly, Brian, and we're going to get to Haiti in just a moment.
And don't forget what Venezuela means for our economy. Now, if there is a crackdown on the business community and more of the opposition in Venezuela, that again pushes more money to South Florida.
And people.
We've seen a tremendous amount of investment from the Venezuelan people here, and you look at all these condos planned across the region. A lot of that is Venezuela and other Latin American countries. So if they make it harder on the opposition because they want to make a point, hey, Chavez may not be in the country, but we're still in charge, that again could drive more money to our shores.
Good point. You're listening to the Florida Roundup, and you can join our conversation. We have the lines open for our Public Insight Network listeners and readers, and they're going to join the conversation in just a moment, but you can do that as well at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. We're also tweetable online on our live online discussion at WLRN and on our Facebook page as well. So in Haiti, the bad news continues. The loss of hope and desperation continues to mount 3 years after the earthquake, and the anniversary is tomorrow at 4:53 p.m. in the afternoon. We asked members of the Public Insight Network what responsibility South Florida has for Haiti's recovery, and here are some of the responses that we received.
Hi, this is Dr. Yacente. South Florida does have a responsibility to assist in Haiti's reconstruction, because not only are there many, many Haitian diasporas have family over in Haiti, but those families are dependent on the families here to assist them. It is also economically and a moral responsibility for us to help. Economically, if we do not help, we're going to have more and more of the individuals in Haiti trying to come here.
Hi, my name is Roland. This crisis in Haiti creates a huge economic opportunity for South Florida in the sense that most building materials are going to be bought here and transported down there. So, of course, shipping companies out of the rebuilding process. So I do think that there is not a responsibility, but there is an interest, an economic interest, in making sure that this reconstruction is done and is done properly.
All right, so there are some PIN members. Nicole, you just went to Haiti, and you've been how many times?
Four times
since the earthquake. What does the place look like now? What does the country look like?
Well, it does look, I will say, better than it did, of course, a few days after the earthquake. I mean, a few days after the earthquake, you can just, you know, imagine bodies in the street, literally. We've seen the pictures, and we've heard the stories, and rubble, you know, blocking roadways. Much of that has been cleaned up. There are still many buildings that are still you know, look like it happened yesterday. The big problem, though, that Haiti has, I think, one of them, isn't even something that's directly affected by or directly stems from the earthquake, but just the very basics of infrastructure. There are no major highways. Sanitation, basic trash pickup is a huge issue. You will have to veer around large piles of garbage in the streets that sometimes people are picking through, that are sitting there in the middle of the streets, landfills that are on the side of the road with, you know, fires burning underneath them. And all of that existed before the earthquake. Of course, the earthquake just exacerbated that. You know, and all these many, many NGOs are doing everything they can. But that's one thing I think that the Martelly administration is trying to do, is trying to come up with some way of sort of managing what all these different individual organizations are doing. But that's a huge task.
And overall, there's consensus among donors and Haitians that progress has been really slow. In fact, I spoke this week with Jacqueline Charles, who's the Herald's mm-hmm. Caribbean Affairs correspondent, the fantastic work that she's done even before the earthquake. But she talks about how, I mean, the money hasn't been spent, and the money hasn't been delivered. Some of the money hasn't been, like, I mean, but what are they going to spend it on? The Haitian government's holding on to some of it. So is that getting in the way of getting the country back on its feet?
That is part of it. We've interviewed President Carter a few times when we've gone down there, and that has always been his big issue, is that the international community is holding back on much of the money that's been pledged. But when Elliot was talking about the oil revenues from Venezuela, that's the Petrocaribe Fund, and they are going to be, when I spoke to the Prime Minister, Laurent Lamothe, make sure I say that right, mm-hmm. he, you know, they're going to be highly dependent on that fund for a lot of their projects, much more, most likely, than some of this aid that they're expecting from the international community. I mean, they've got a very ambitious plan, but much of that money also has to be paid back in 18 years. So you wonder how successful they can be.
Well, we did put the call out, and more members of our Public Insight Network responded this week. Here is Henrika from Coral Gables, who actually leads the EcoWorks International, which is an organization that's worked in Haiti for the past 4 years and is back here in Florida at the moment. Hi, Henrika. How are you?
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what progress have you seen made since the earthquake?
Well, as I think Nicole mentioned, the rubble is out and certain buildings have been propped up, but there are huge issues. And I think one of the problems that perhaps people don't speak enough about is that out of the 14 ministries, 12 went down with people inside, equipment and archives and everything else. So now the ministries function in temporary hangars, basically, which are very difficult conditions to work. Also, I believe that Prime Minister Lamothe has been trying to change the personnel of those ministries to make it more accountable and more energetic. I think from our point of view, and we are an NGO which works, as you mentioned, in Haiti, is that we would love to have a national plan for development. I think at this point, talking about disaster relief really is no longer viable. At this point, we need to talk about long-term development, not only how we build houses, but how we build homes, how we build communities. To put 50,000 people away from the capital in a place where there are houses but there is nothing else, mm-hmm. including no transportation, no schools, no clinics, is absurd because those people have no way of getting to places where there are jobs. So we need to really shift gears, and we need to start talking about how do we plan ahead and how do we build communities with parks, with clinics, with schools, and with jobs.
I spoke to some members of the Haitian community this week, and a couple of them told me that the diaspora here sort of checked out. Talk about that connection and what people here in South Florida can do to continue to make sure that happens, that there is a plan that the country does get back on its feet.
Well, in terms of diaspora, if you look at the countries that have been extremely successful in the last 70, 80 years, Israel, Singapore, China, India, and so on, the diaspora of each of those countries played an enormous role in its rebuilding. Now, the Haitian diaspora here, for example, in South Florida, has been extremely successful in sending money to their relatives. One-third of the GDP in Haiti comes from remittances. So that's a very big success and important. Where I think there have been problems is that the diaspora is fractured and fragmented. And I believe that all the programs that have been attempted to unify and to make the diaspora think beyond the remittances and think in terms of large economic and social development programs, that has been a failure. And in my opinion, from my observation, I would say that perhaps what we need to do is to contact the professional Haitian diaspora organizations, for example, such as the engineers, because they seem to have transcended their differences, political and otherwise, and they focus on their common skills, common experiences, and those experiences are vital for the rebuilding of Haiti.
Enrique, I wanted to get Nicole in on this because she's covered both parts, both ends from on this country and in this region. What do you think of the responsibility that we have here?
Well, that is, you know, it's interesting when she said that that many of the Haitian Americans in South Florida seem to have checked out. I hear the same thing. You know, I came back from Haiti last time after speaking to the prime minister with all of his ambitious plans and, you know, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And, you know, and it sounds ambitious, like a very big project to undertake, but, you know, a lot of energy behind it. And then when you come back here, a lot of Haitian Americans say, okay, it'll never change.
What do you guys say? You know, Elliot, quickly before we go to the break, what's our responsibility here 3 years after this thing?
Well, I think it sounds to me like it becomes an economic issue for us here in South Florida. If the better that we're doing here, and if one-third of the GDP in Haiti comes from remittances from here, the better the Haitian American community can help their folks back home.
And Brian, as the caller from the Public Insight Network told us, you know, it means a lot to South Florida's economy as well to help rebuild Haiti.
I think that there are private investment that could take place in Haiti, especially manufacturing, because the cost of living is fairly low there. You could have good manufacturing there. The problem is you need infrastructure, you need real roads, you need garbage out of the street, and then you can get real manufacturing. But it's hard to get companies in there until they have a platform that can support it.
All right, we're going to continue this discussion for just a bit when we come back. You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Our guest this hour, Brian Bendel from the South Florida Business Journal. Still some things we're going to get to about mortgages and homes with him, general economy stuff. Also, Elliot Rodriguez from CBS 4 WFOR, plenty on the plate for him to come. And Nicole Insulata from Channel 7 will continue talking about Haiti when we come back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. We'll continue our discussion on Haiti here for just a moment. We did ask members of the Public Insight Network to weigh in on what's the responsibility of our community and rebuilding efforts 3 years after the earthquake when things seem to only be getting worse and there's more desperation. We certainly feel it here in a very large South Florida Haitian diaspora. So Junior is in West Palm Beach. Actually, let's go to Mary Lou first. Is that what you want me to do there, young lady? Elaine Chen, our associate producer? You can make the call on that one. I think we should go to Mary Lou first. I think that's what she told us. So let's go to Mary Lou. She is in Miami and joining us through the Public Insight Network. Hi there. Welcome. And how have Haiti's struggles affected our region, Mary Lou?
Hi, Phil. Thanks for having me. You know, I feel that while the struggles in Haiti have not directly affected me, I'm a Cuban American, I think that it affects us all on an emotional level. You know, Haiti's no more than 700 miles away, and the people are suffering, and they're still suffering, obviously, the loss of family and friends in this tragic earthquake, but life-altering events that they're suffering on a daily basis due to a lack of sanitary conditions, appropriate shelter, basic necessities, just as clean water. I mean, they had the largest outbreak in cholera in about 60 years that's been plaguing them for almost 2 years now. And we all need to get involved. And while, yes, the U.S. has said that, you know, we signed a promise with Congress, passed in 2010 for relief efforts. We promised to rebuild and replace all these destroyed homes, or at least thousands of them. None of them have been built. And it's a multi-layered issue, you know. It's not just from a local standpoint here in South Florida, but it's tackling corruption and a lack of education, the fact that 53% of Haitians are illiterate. It's staggering. It's devastating.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so complex, but We need more education from a U.S. standpoint on the issues that are plaguing the nation, and more involvement from people that can make a direct impact, you know, whether it be through a network of getting the resources needed, like clean water and clothes and all these issues. But I think it's a conversation that needs to be brought up. I think it's been out of the White House for a while now.
Nicole, you've reported a lot. What organized efforts have you seen by the diaspora here and reactions to asks for requests from help from the national level?
Well, when we went to Haiti last time, especially, we've noticed, especially now that the airport has been somewhat expanded as well as rebuilt after the earthquake, many of the flights now going over there are completely full. Many people from South Florida going back and forth, visiting family. But as she was talking, talking about how it's such a complex problem, there are so many other things now that they're starting to focus on. In addition, and as your other caller said, to disaster relief, which is sort of, we've kind of passed that point. Now the government is working on getting more people into the schools, which cost in Haiti. There's a fee to go to school in Haiti. And also in terms of the infrastructure, bringing in businesses, the Clinton Global Initiative also was instrumental in bringing in a new industrial park, which also attracted then an apparel company, I think, from South Korea. So it's those little moves, I think, that are going to end up, you know, starting this complex problem to at least come together somewhat. I'm hoping that the Haitian American community here in South Florida can get more involved in that, and not just these larger international organizations like the Clinton Global Initiative, which has done a lot of work in Haiti.
All right. Junior is in West Palm Beach. He's a Haitian American, and he's going to have the last word from our Public Insight Network. Hi, Junior. Welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Thank you. How you doing?
Doing well. So you went to Haiti last March, and what have you seen the progress in the country from your perspective?
Personally, what I've seen in the progress is, I still see evidence of loss remain 3 years after the massive earthquake debris is not completely cleared out. It still is a fragile infrastructure still in ruin. We also have a little opportunity to build the infrastructure to deal with waste disposal, collection, removal. We need, like, recycler center. Food supply is very fragile. And, you know, I know Haiti won't be able to become a middle-income country overnight, but a lot can be done in the sense that the Haitian government and, you know, the Haitian elite, you know, basically should try to give the Haitian masses the opportunity to grow. It's just too much Haitian corruption. It's too much. It's like I was hearing from your previous callers and everything. They basically summing up everything. It's a very complex issue. And the Haitian diaspora, in Haitian terms, should try to get into helping. But I feel like it's a lack of education and literacy for them to understand what needs to be done in Haiti.
And you told us that you think that the help is really, at least your mother thinks that the help is going to really come from this side of the water, not in Haiti. Like you think that it's really up to South Florida to step up.
I could say 2 nights ago we were sitting down, we were talking about it, and she basically brought up a statement saying that it's not the kids in Haiti, or in a sense the kid that is born in Haiti, that will be able to change the aspect of Haiti. It's the ones that come from Haiti and end up living the American dream, and also the ones that was born here as the Haitian American that knows what's good, or what sees what the economy is about and what freedom is. Those are the ones that needs to go back into that country to redevelop the country. Because the ones that's in Haiti, they're basically in a small box. They don't know what's really good, is what she was telling me.
Junior, thanks so much for your call. Very well said. It was great to have you. Thanks for being part of the Public Insight Network and being on our show today with your insights.
All right, thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. So just to put a capper on it, 3 years later, could this be a good year in Haiti after all the bad news we hear? You may be going back, Nicole. Could this be the year where things improve in Haiti?
Well, it's hard to have hope, I will be honest with you. And especially if you speak to many Haitian Americans, there's not a whole lot of hope there. But there is so much good work being done in individual patches. Let's hope that it all at some point comes together. And just very quickly, locally, we should also mention Project Metashare, which comes from University of Miami, doing incredible work at their hospital there as well.
Good mention. We want to remind you, you are listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLR, and we spend a lot of time on Haiti's third-year anniversary. I don't know if the government in Haiti is even doing anything officially to mark it. Certainly hit us hard here, and we thank Nicole for giving us her insights on that. We also have Elliot Rodriguez from CBS4 and Brian Bandel from the South Florida Business Journal, and I want to remind you, if you miss any portion of the program, it always is online, living there at WLRN.org. We also broadcast Saturday mornings at 6 a.m. You may be listening to that now. Good morning. We can also be found on Facebook. You can search for the Florida Roundup. Twitter handles quickly, Nicole. Yours is?
And Lynn Salata at WSVN.
Elliot, you are?
Erod, CBS4.
And Brian?
It's Brian Bandel, B-A-N-D-E-L-L. And if you check me out there, you'll see I mentioned an event I'm doing February 11th at the University of Miami Alumni Center on journalism and writing.
All right, and I'm going to ask you about South Florida's real estate situation in just a moment, though. The big news here locally, part of the big news, we talked last week, we put our query about the name change in Broward County. And whether Broward should change its name to Fort Lauderdale County. Some business and civic leaders feel Broward should be out and should instead be called Lauderdale or Fort Lauderdale County. At a panel discussion held yesterday, in fact, by local business executives, advertising mogul Jordan Zimmerman said Fort Lauderdale is an easier sell than Broward.
To those of you and those of us that say Fort Lauderdale is too closely associated with partying and spring break, I want to remind every one of us Where the Boys Are was filmed 52 years ago. That's a lifetime.
Sorry there, Jordan. Any name change would have to get the approval of county commissioners and voters, and business owner Millie Walsh of Lighthouse Point says that would be too expensive.
I am not for it. I think it's a waste of money. Money better spent in our community, keeping our houses, our businesses alive. I think there's many better places to spend the money.
I think all of us here on this panel remember when Miami-Dade County changed, or Metro-Dade, what do we call it?
Just Dade, Dade,
just Dade County.
Metropolitan-Dade
County changed its name. Elliot, 16 years ago, do you think this could have a benefit for Broward if they change their name?
I think that Jordan Zimmerman makes a lot of good points. I mean, Fort Lauderdale is the largest city in Broward County. It's got national, international name recognition. How many people in Broward know that their county is named after Napoleon Bonaparte Broward, who was a governor of Florida in the early 20th century, who was one of the leaders in draining the Everglades so that they can have farmland. It makes sense, although there is a cost involved. Think about it. They would have to change. Would they change the name of the Broward Sheriff's Office? It would be the Fort Lauderdale Sheriff's Office. They'd have to change each patrol car, all the uniforms, all the stationery. They can't even get Fort Lauderdale on the airport. It's Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport. I don't know what their chances are going to be of changing the name of the county to Fort Lauderdale or maybe Lauderdale County, but I think it does have a nice ring to it.
So, Brian, what's in a name?
I don't know that any business is not going to come here because it's not called Fort Lauderdale County. That doesn't seem to hamper Atlanta or Chicago or other big cities that have the county named after the biggest city. I mean, it's an icebreaker, like, I'm from Broward County. Where's that? You know, Fort Lauderdale. Like, okay. I mean, you can get over that in about 2 seconds. I don't think it's hindering us.
And one other Broward County note this week, the county has a new sheriff. Scott Israel was sworn into office this week after defeating incumbent Al Lamberti in November. And the Broward Sheriff's Office is one of the most powerful elected positions in the county of all of South Florida, about 5,500 employees, Elliot, $670 million budget. This is a big job and a big transition.
It is a big job. And on his first day, the new sheriff, Scott Israel, was called out to a shooting that involved a BSO deputy who shot a woman whose family claims she was mentally impaired. And that is still under investigation. So he's got his hands full for sure.
And there's always, Nicole, the stories about how, you know, BSO is sort of this multi-headed hydra in Broward County. With in charge of some of a lot of unincorporated areas, obviously, and then some cities that contract them out to use their services.
So. Yeah, absolutely. But back to the name change, I'm also wondering, you know, has it helped Hallandale Beach, Dania Beach? I know when I moved back here, we had the new city of Miami Gardens, new to me, because I had just moved back. And I'm wondering if, I guess my question is, really, what is the point? I mean, when the one caller talked about the cost of doing all this, and you're talking about Broward Sheriff's Office, are we going to have FTLSO, and they're going to have to change everything? With governments so strapped for cash right now, so strapped, especially the sheriff's office, and public safety is an issue, is that worth spending money on?
Yeah.
I'm not really sure.
How much it would cost is another story. We have to mention this. Elliot, you and I are long enough. I think everybody in this room remembers the days of Joe Arroyo. And he took over as Doral City manager. He replaced ex-Miami-Dade schools boss Merritt Stierheim, of course known once as Crazy Joe Arroyo, and may still be known as that after a news conference yesterday. He was the mayor of Miami. He was arrested on domestic battery charges after throwing a teapot at his wife back in the late 1990s. He ran unsuccessfully for the job in 1997, but got it after Xavier Suarez was booted out for ballot fraud and then lost re-election. Arroyo recommended Stierheim, who's been county manager, chair of convention and Visitors Bureau. He's had just about every job in the book. It's pretty well respected. Recommended him for the job. Yesterday, though, he slammed him in front of the media for things that happened 16 years ago. Here's from MiamiHerald.com, Arroyo's rambling news conference.
I resent the fact that he started bad-mouthing and complaining about what former Mayor Pinellas and others in county government did to him. I resent that he talk bad about numerous members of the school board when he worked for them. And history repeats itself. The same thing again happened.
Arroyo says Stierheim, quote, thought Hispanics couldn't govern themselves and that he considers himself the great white hope, opening up a new can of worms.
Well, Phil, you know what I think? I think the news gods were looking down upon us and said, you know, you guys need to cover Doral more often, because now you got a guy who every time he opens his mouth, he's going to say something outrageous. And that's the history of Joe Arroyo when he was the mayor of Miami, when he was a Miami commissioner. And now the city of Doral, which was run, had a mayor, J.C. Bermudez, who did a great job, and that city is financially strong. Our station is even located right in Doral. I can't count the number of times that we had a story, a controversial story about Doral, but now with Joe Arroyo one day on the job, and he's already bringing up ethnic tensions and saying that, oh, Merritt Stierheim doesn't think Hispanics can run a city. When you have Merritt Stierheim, who has a long track record in Miami-Dade County, again, the news gods were looking down on us, and I think we're going to be hearing more about Joe Arroyo and the city of Doral.
Yeah, he's the Ozzie Guillen of politics.
Love it.
We're moving to Miami, to Doral as well, so it'll be interesting. All right, Brian, I'll leave the last word for you. You're reporting a lot on home sales and home mortgages. Really, as far as the sales are surging, but prices are not really going up too much. Is that a summation of what you're working on?
Well, sales are surging. Loans are not really surging. That's the paradox we're in. I was looking at home mortgage disclosure information from 2011. Despite the huge increase in sales that year, the home mortgages in South Florida only increased by about 2%. That's only at 1,500 loans. South Florida, although it's the 8th largest metro region, it's the 20th largest only for lending. So there seems to be a problem here in loan volume. And the other thing I saw was a large amount of the loans, 70 cents of every dollar, went to upper income borrowers. So you see, the upper income people have a much easier time getting a loan now. It's much harder for the middle class and especially the lower class to get loans. And you can read a lot more about this in next week's South Florida Business Journal.
Yeah, Brian does a lot of work, covers a lot of ground for the South Florida Business Journal. Brian, it's always great to have you here with all your information. You always come prepared.
Thank you so much.
Elliot Rodriguez from CBS4 WFOR Television going into anchor, what, the 5:30 newscast?
The 5, 5:30, 6, and 11. Hopefully your listeners will tune in.
And Nicole and Salata competing on the other side. So maybe you catch one, you go over to 7, you go back to 4. It's great to have you here, too, as well.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for all your great reporting on Haiti. And we thank everybody who participated through the Public Insight Network this week. That does it for the Florida Roundup this Friday, January the 11th, 2013. We have the show rebroadcast on Saturday mornings. We also post it on our website at WLRN.org. We're produced by Alicia Zuckerman. Elaine Chen, our associate producer, Public Insight Network analyst Steph Farrow, helped us get the pin responses. Executive producer for WLRN, Peter J. Meritz. For WLRN Miami Herald News, it's Dan Gretsch. Technical supervisor, Paul Leary. Until next week, I'm Phil Latzman, and stay informed, South Florida. Thanks for listening.